This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Our lead story today is brought to you by the letter C for capitalism. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on a Thursday, everybody. It's the 13th of August today. And quick, which one of these is not like the other? Game of Thrones, True Detective, Sesame Street, and, Boardwalk Empire, maybe? Ha! Trick question, because you factor out the violence and the nudity and maybe the bad language, and they are more alike than you think, those shows. Sesame Street is relocating to HBO, home of some of the most grown-up content out there. Yes, new episodes are still going to be available on PBS, but HBO is going to get them first because, surprise, television is expensive to make. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on the economic realities that have Big Bird headed behind a paywall.
Oh, greetings! It is I, the Count! And
if instead of tallying bats, the Count were to peer through his monocle at Sesame Workshop's financials, he'd see millions in losses. Sesame spends $115 million a year, with nearly $7 million just on what its accountants call Muppet acquisition. Even though Sesame Street aired on PBS, most of the money to pay for all that came from elsewhere. Jim Steyer is CEO of the nonprofit Common Sense Media.
The reason Sesame Workshop was able to keep producing Sesame Street at very high cost is because they had extraordinary DVD and merchandising revenue, and that has started to decline.
DVDs are pretty worthless in a streaming age. University of Georgia professor Jeffrey Jones directs the Peabody Awards, which have honored Sesame Street and HBO over the years.
The ability to extend its franchise, extend its brand, and in particular get that type of funding from a private source is just enormously important for them.
You're listening to Public Media right now, so you may have a problem with paying to see new Sesame Street episodes. Jones and others acknowledge the potential for backlash, but putting new episodes behind a paywall is a way to cover the cost of making quality shows, says John Swallen, chief research officer at Cantor Media.
If HBO is the corporate partner that can fund that and help that happen, as opposed to their prior relationship with PBS, then that's the way the chips fall.
For its money, HBO gets top-drawer children's content, a hook to lure subscribers. Parents and kids still have Sesame Street, just not the way they used to. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Turns out our off-lead is brought to you by the letter C for capitalism as well, because for the third time in as many days, the Bank of China has devalued the Chinese yuan another percent or so against the dollar. Today's market intervention, however, came with a rare Bank of China press conference to, in theory, explain what is going on over there. Our Shanghai Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has been following this story all week for us. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So this was an unusual and interesting press conference, I think you could say, huh?
Yeah, and the central bank's vice governor said something really interesting when he was trying to emphasize how the bank was going to let the market determine the value of China's currency. He said, rather eloquently, trust the market, respect the market, fear the market, and follow the market. Now, I'm not sure which one of those he thought China was doing most, but if I were a betting man, I'd pick fear the market, because that's what the central bank is doing. It seems scared to give away its power to the market. Yesterday, toward the end of a rough day of trading, the bank dumped $20 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bills to bring the value of China's currency up a little. Now, that's a drop in the bucket when you consider China owns $3.6 trillion right. worth of U.S. T-bills. But today, it fixed the currency depreciation at 1%. So there's a bit of a contradiction between what China's central bank is saying and what it's actually doing. It knows that all this free market talk is what global markets want to hear, but Beijing is still very much controlling the value of the currency.
Do you suppose they have a plan? I mean, I get that that's a big question, but it looks for all the world like they're going, oh my goodness, what do we do today?
Yeah, I think that is the big question. You know, some economists think this is all part of a big strategy to internationalize the yuan. And in order to do that, the IMF wants a more market-based currency price. The timing of this devaluation a month before the Fed potentially decides on interest rate hike and a month before Xi Jinping and Obama meet in the United States is pretty interesting. You know, but a lot of other economists think China's central bank is acting without much of a script. You know, the way they've handled this devaluation, the deception about it, as well as how Beijing has mismanaged the Shanghai Stock Exchange debacle by quickly seizing control of the situation, making them look like they're not very serious about letting the market decide. Well, that's not exactly a recipe for confidence in how the Chinese government is handling all of this.
What should we be more worried about? The fact that the government is intervening in the currency markets and the stock exchange, as we've seen, or that what they are doing doesn't seem to be working the way they want it to?
I think the latter. I think that's the one that everyone's worried about, because if they're working kind of untethered and they're sort of in panic mode, I think everyone's going to be in trouble.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for the third day in a row. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Kai.
A little bumpy, a little up and down, a little here and there on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider this the next time you're stuck on what you think is a long airplane ride. Emirates Airlines is about to start service from its hub in Dubai to Panama City, Panama. En route time will be about 17 hours, 35 minutes, or probably forever if you're on board. Long distance routes are the heart of the Emirates business model, but as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports, there is some turbulence ahead.
Emirates Airlines has established a reputation for offering a lavish flying experience. The company's website boasts of mid-flight showers, meals of Iranian caviar, and braised beef in coconut milk. Bijan Vasile is with the ACG Aviation Consulting Group.
Their service is fantastic, and passengers are really liking the airline.
And more, American travelers are getting a taste. According to the Center for Aviation, Emirates is adding a record 600,000 seats in the U.S. this year, which is projected to give the company more than 2 million by 2016. Vasile says those numbers, not the extravagances, have grabbed U.S. competitors' attention.
Outside competition is getting bigger and bigger. Therefore, the fear is that they are capturing more and more customers from U.S. airlines.
In response, Delta, United, and American Airlines accuse Emirates, a state-run entity, of benefiting from UAE subsidies, a claim Emirates denies. If that claim has any merit, it could significantly curb Emirates' ability to grow, at least in the U.S. But industry analyst Mike Boyd says the carrier has more immediate concerns.
Well, they're buying these Airbus A380s that can handle up to 600 passengers. That's a lot of airplane, and you better be able to fill them up. If you fill them up, you make a lot of money. You don't fill them up, you lose a lot of money.
Boyd says Emirates' success hinges on its ability to move passengers across continents. It certainly helps to get someone on a plane for nearly 18 hours with promises of caviar, fine wine, and a shower. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
All right, let's talk about unmanned aerial vehicles for a minute now. Drones, in other words. There are a whole bunch of questions about exactly how they are going to share the skies with one another and with anything else that flies as well. Marketplace's Abri Benishore explores some of those questions.
A man in Connecticut put a gun on his drone. Totally illegally, by the way. He was arrested. Doctors from Johns Hopkins used drones to move blood samples. And yet the biggest unanswered questions around drones involve neither of those things. Ryan Kahlo is a law professor at the University of Washington. Big question number one, he says, is about privacy.
How do we make sure that these drones are not recording things that they shouldn't, and those things are winding up, you know, in Amazon servers or somehow getting out into the public or to law enforcement?
Legally, the higher up the camera, the less your right to privacy. But between 5 feet and 500 feet is a big gray area. And Kahlo says the drones will have cameras. They'll have to.
Because not only are people taking down drones just to do it, including with shotguns, right? But now these things will be carrying, you know, iPads.
As shoplifting becomes skylifting, which is its own problem, the drones will have to take in a lot of information to protect themselves, and that could conflict with privacy. Another question, how low can a drone pass before it's trespassing or a nuisance?
Trespass and nuisance have typically, since the founding, been almost solely dealt with at the state and local level.
Greg McNeil teaches at Pepperdine University and founded a navigation company for drones. He says constitutionally, every town can have its own altitude trespassing laws, and that could cost fuel and time.
So if the Amazon or Google or other delivery drone, as it flies over Berkeley, it has to go up to 500 feet. And as it flies over Mountain View, California, it's able to dip down to, you know, 150 feet. That becomes really problematic.
A huge unanswered question for drones, though, is simply, what are the rules for flying? The FAA is so far behind drone technology, it hasn't come up with final rules for drones in general, let alone automated delivery drones. Brendan Schulman is with drone maker DJI.
And it would be a shame if we then had to wait another 10 years for the regulations.
Drones, for now, are faster than the law. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Last month, the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, you might have heard the name in a presidential context, signed a state budget that cut the University of Wisconsin's budget by $250 million. Yesterday, Walker signed a spending plan approving $250 million to be spent on a new arena for the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks. The economics of taxpayer-funded arenas and stadiums are never very far from the politics of them, as Marketplace's Gigi Duban explains.
When a government pours money into a sports venue like the new arena plan for the Milwaukee Bucks, sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's a subsidy or an investment. Mark Rosentraub teaches sport management at the University of Michigan.
It becomes an investment when there's a clearly defined set of returns that are worth the risk of any investment.
He says if the arena anchors a bigger redevelopment plan, that's when it tends to make a city money. But arenas alone don't equal jobs and new businesses, especially in a quiet city like Milwaukee, says Andrew Zimbalist, economics professor at Smith College.
If you're hoping to promote the local economy by attracting or keeping a basketball team, that's not something that happens.
And the more public money goes into a venture like this, the less it helps the local economy. This deal is 50-50, public and private money. The Bucks are owned by two New York hedge fund managers. Zimbalist says the average in the NBA is two-thirds public money.
On the other hand, some of the public money that they're putting in is kind of shaky.
Like collecting back taxes and visitor taxes, both dicey. Ted Geyer, VP and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, says it doesn't pay for cities, but it does for teams.
Sports leagues are leagues. They're actually pretty savvy about this.
And if they know a city wants them to stay, he says, they have leverage in negotiating more money to stay. And that, to a lot of fans, is enough. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, the economics of retail, one tour bus at a time.
Think of us as storytellers slash translators slash guides.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 5 points today, just a tiny fraction, closed at 17,408. The NASDAQ off 10 points, about 0.2%, finished at 5,033. The S&P 500 off 2 points, 0.1% there, ended things at 2,083. Quick commodity check here before some corporate news. Crude oil continued its recent slide, hit a six-year low, West Texas Intermediate did. Going rate for light crude now about $42 a barrel, off 2.5% just today. Coals, ticker KSS, by the by, took a hit on lower-than-expected sales in the second quarter. The department store chain said part of the reason is the tax-free holidays this month. Delayed back-to-school shopping. Coal shares off 8.75%. No, that's not a typo. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Secretary of State John Kerry visits Cuba. The Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for July. And now, let's do the time warp. The Rocky Horror Picture Show premiered in London 40 years ago on August 14, 1975. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the season, for another couple of weeks anyway, of summer travel, of journeys to postcard-worthy destinations. If you're a certain kind of traveler, maybe climbing on a tour bus for some guided sightseeing is a thing you do. As it happens, our next story is about a very particular kind of guided tour, one whose passengers aren't tourists hoping for a good shot of, say, the Golden Gate Bridge, but rather they are executives from one of America's biggest companies trying to find their way around the ever-changing consumer landscape in this country. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is going to take you along for the ride.
All right, everybody, on your magical mystery tour.
I'm sitting in a pleasantly air-conditioned charter bus, surrounded by lots of polo shirts and button-downs and other forms of corporate casual.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
You guys also have sunscreen if anyone wants any.
Worn by members of the upper management team from Lowe's, you know, the big box home improvement chain.
I'm the chief supply chain officer.
Director in marketing consumer insights.
General merchandising manager for seasonal.
All these people, and about a dozen more like them, have just flown to Los Angeles from Lowe's headquarters outside Charlotte, North Carolina, so they can get on this bus, where, at the moment, we are driving down a potholed, not very picturesque street. Everybody's necks are craned toward the windows. They've been told to keep their eye out for something. And soon enough, they spot it. A black building with the name Habitat painted in big white letters.
Where is it?
Habitat. Right.
Habitat is a new coffee shop in the area. But for the purposes of this bus tour, it is so much more than that. It is a sign that this urban working-class neighborhood we're driving through is on its way to becoming cool. And why do a bunch of suburban box store executives care about urban cool? Well, here's one of my busmates, Tanya Franklin, Lowe's Director of Market and Consumer Insights.
Last fall, actually all of last year, we were trying to really reevaluate how we look at consumer trends and just some of the shifts taking place among consumers, not just how they shop, but also how they live.
And more to the point, where they live, because recently it's been changing.
People moving back into the city, inner city rings are really evolving.
For years, inner city rings did not show up on the radar of a mass retail giant like Lowe's. The suburbs, big generic shopping malls, those were the best bets for finding lots of customers with money to spend. But the suburbs are getting poorer. And that holy grail of retail demographics, the millennials, they are flocking to gentrifying neighborhoods like this one that we're driving through right now. Leaders at Lowe's realized they needed to get a better handle on what makes this new generation tick, which is why they're on this bus.
All right, guys, so take notes, please, so we can relay our experiences to the other team.
The guy helping the Lowe's team get a handle on this is Stefan Pascalidis. He's sitting at the front of the bus, pointing out the window at what, to an untrained eye, might just look like a fairly run-down urban street. But Pascalidis is helping his passengers see it differently.
So, guys, this is an interesting mix of the old and new, with, you know, two juice shops. So, you know, it's gentrified when there's two juice shops.
Pascalidis calls himself a cultural insights consultant. His company, Now Plus One, takes big corporate brands, Clorox, Frito-Lay, and today, Lowe's, on tours like this one. He calls them insight immersions.
Think of us as storytellers slash translators slash guides.
Each tour for each client has a specific theme. He's done the concept of masculinity for Pepsi, the concept of realness for Purina,
And then there's this Lowe's tour, all about the changing demographic landscape.
So you recommend the...
I'm going to get the banh mi because I love a good banh mi.
We stop for lunch in one of the hottest urban neighborhoods in L.A. these days, Highland Park, at a restaurant called Good Girl Dinette. It's got a shiny orange counter and exposed brick walls. Pascalitas describes the place as comfort food with Vietnamese flair.
So, guys, sorry, may I have your attention?
This place, Pascalitas tells his group, reflects what he calls the cultural hybridity of Southern California. And then he explains what a banh mi sandwich is. The manager of the restaurant comes over, a young guy with a beard, and Pascalitas takes the opportunity to mine him for information.
I just wanted him to tell us a little bit about this place and the neighborhood and the kind of folks who patronize this place.
It's a wonderful smattering of people that have lived here since before any of us were born, and then newbies like me who just moved to the neighborhood and just are yearning for something that feels like kind of real and sincere and this is, like, as real as you can get.
One of the Lowe's executives jots down real in his notebook. They got handed out at the beginning of the tour with a list of questions to consider for each stop along the way. Like, what role does comfort food play in an urban environment? What about the restaurant's aesthetic communicates its culinary intent?
Okay, so what do you write here?
Troy Daly, a senior vice president at Lowe's, let me look at his notes.
I was just talking about eclectic food combination. He was talking about a lot of artsy folks come in, and so the vegetarian and vegan was the selection that really thought brought those in.
Daly says it's not like Lowe's is planning on suddenly getting into the food business or anything.
From my standpoint, it's really getting to understand the customer outside of our world.
After the restaurant, we get back on the bus.
Why are you walking this slow for there?
Most of the team agrees the banh mi sandwiches were delicious, though.
A lot of garlic.
The tour lasts 8 hours. We go to a DIY woodworking shop where they teach people how to make their own wooden spoons.
You can kind of feel here. Those are the tool paths that are left by the mill.
We stop by a new condo development that Pascalitas explains is redefining the concept of community space.
I know you guys have some unique things, including a private dog park and a vegetable patch. Is that correct?
At the stop where we meet a successful real estate guy who tours us through a house he's just flipped.
Steve is one of the sort of real estate innovators in this area.
It's all about
authenticity and integrity. Authenticity and integrity. Does that make sense?
I don't know what you mean by authenticity.
Authenticity, so in the homes that we do, so I use, like, the nice materials. We use the marble. We use the nice hardwood floors.
By the end of the bus tour, our heads are buzzing with buzzwords, meant to evoke what the 21st century urban consumer wants. Some folks are stealing naps at the back of the bus. At one point, we drive down another street in what may or may not be an up-and-coming neighborhood, and Lowe's chief supply chain officer, Steve Salaggi, pipes up.
Saw a yogurt shop back
yogurt
there.
Shop.
A for effort, but the yogurt trend is kind of over.
Yeah, the yogurt trend is way over. We have gotten Chrissy Clark in the studio with us to talk about that piece a little bit. First of all, Chrissy, welcome back
you.
To the show, I guess.
Thank you.
How did you get on that bus?
So, funny story. Yeah. I was actually invited to go onto the bus as an expert.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So, which I did, that was not my role in the end. But as you know, we did this series last year about Highland Park and about changing urban neighborhoods. And
York and Fig.
York and Fig, yes. And Stefan Pascalitas, the tour guide, he had run across that series as he was doing research for this Insight Immersion that he was putting together for Lowe's. So he emailed me and said, hey, you know all about how urban neighborhoods are changing. Can you join us and share some of your insights with these Lowe's people? And I said, I'm a business journalist. Yeah. I'm not a business consultant. No, I respectfully decline that invitation to be an expert. But I did say, God, I would love to be a fly on the wall and see how this all plays out and do a story about it. So they said, sure, come along. And it was such a vivid illustration, not just of the fact that the demographics of urban neighborhoods are changing and suburban neighborhoods are changing, but how businesses like Lowe's are scrambling to learn about this change and to capitalize on
it. So what have they done? I mean, Lowe's is a big store. Where have they, you know, put this into practice?
Yeah, well, I called them this week to say, you know, can you share any of the things that have come out of this? They said, well, that's proprietary. We don't, we don't want our rivals to know about that. But you can already see the ways that they're responding to some of these changes. They're about to open their first store in Manhattan.
Oh, wow.
And then they have a second one that's going to be coming out in a couple of months. So clearly, and when I spoke with the CEO briefly on the tour, he was like, we need to be thinking about urban neighborhoods.
Wow, that's like a Home Depot in Manhattan. Get me back to York and Fig for a minute. The series that Wealth and Poverty did last year up in Highland Park, which is part of where you were for this thing. Have you been back?
Right. So just to remind listeners, or if they didn't hear it, we did this series last year where we actually opened up a little news bureau, a little pop-up bureau in Highland Park, this neighborhood that was undergoing a lot of change from a working class Latino neighborhood to a sort of hip urban neighborhood like the one we were exploring. In the last few weeks, we've been checking back in with some of the folks who we met back then, and we've actually compiled a little podcast that revisits some of the original coverage we did last year and some updates on kind of where they are now. So you can get that at marketplace.org/YorkandFig. We'll also be doing some stories over the next couple of weeks looking more deeply into how the neighborhood has continued to evolve and what neighborhoods like Highland Park and other urban neighborhoods around the country are doing to try to respond to some of these changes and preserve some of the culture and the people that are kind of disappearing from these places.
Because that was one of the things we saw last year in your reporting, is that the people, you know, who had been there for literally generations weren't quite sure what to make of this.
Right, exactly. And so we have some interesting stories about sort of ways people are trying to adapt and push back to some of the changes.
All right. She said it once, I'll say it again, marketplace.org/YorkandFig, right?
York and Fig.
Chrissy Clark. Thank you, Chrissy.
Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn, I guess, that Breakfast of Champions means different things to different people. A craft brewery up in Minnesota is teaming up with General Mills to create Heffa Wheaties. Yes, based on the cereal. Comes in an orange can with the Wheaties branding, the whole deal. It's available starting in a couple of weeks in the Twin Cities only, I think. I'm not a big wheat beer guy, so somebody, try it. Let me know how it is, all right? And with that, we are out of here. The Dow up 5 points today, a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ off 10 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 down about 2 points. That is a 10th percent on that particular index. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.